This is the Education Gadfly Show.
Son, in particular, just went swimming.
My advice is send them to boarding school.
Yes.
What does Gadfly say?
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute. Here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at fordhaminstitute.org. And now, please welcome my special guest for this week, the original Education Gadfly, Checker Finn.
Glad to be with you and feeling very special.
Excellent. Good to have you here, Checker. Also joining us, our co-host, David Griffith.
Hey, Mike. Feeling comparatively unoriginal here, but good to be here.
Yes, indeed. Well, great to have you guys on. We were just chatting. I was saying that my oldest son turned 13 today. Folks who have been listening to the podcast since the very beginning remember when he was born. We've been on the air that long. Exciting. And wow, I tell you, it adds some perspective to your life. 13, Checker. Any advice for dealing with teenagers? As I recall, your work with your teenage son in particular just went swimmingly.
My advice is send them to boarding school.
Yes. Okay.
What's to live by, Mike?
I'll perhaps ask for some advice from some other people. Okay. We are excited to have Checker on the show, and we are going to talk about an issue that he cares deeply about and has been writing about, and that is what the heck is going on with America's exam schools. Let's do that in Ed Reform Update. All right, Checker. Well, several years ago, you and a colleague wrote the definitive book on exam schools, the public schools that admit students selectively, often via exams or other admissions processes. I think you found, something like 150 of these around the country?
Yeah, I think 164 of them. These are high schools, of course, and they had to be the self-contained kind of complete school, yeah. Like the famous ones, like Boston Latin and Stuyvesant, not some kind of a program within a comprehensive school. But right. It was a very small number, and some cities didn't have any.
Right. I mean, you look at, I think there was a map. You know, it's clustered largely in the Northeast, Midwest, but not as much out West, as I recall.
That's right.
With a few exceptions. Well, here we are. We find ourselves not only in the middle of a big pandemic, but also another national reckoning with racial injustice. And there are a lot of people out there very concerned that many of these schools have very low numbers of students of color, at least if you don't count Asian Americans, in their student populations. And so there is a renewed effort to try to fix that. Tell us what you see out there and what you think of it.
It's part and parcel of a kind of war on exclusivity, elitism, meritocracy, and testing that's going on all over the place. It's also part of a war on gifted education that is going on in a lot of places. You could argue that exam schools are sort of the pinnacle of gifted education. These are for smart high school kids who have already proven that they're good at stuff, and they've been able to get into these selective schools. In an awful lot of places, including six of those big eastern cities that you alluded to, that are well known for having at least a few of this kind of school, they're really under attack because their admissions process doesn't produce a look like the city demographic in the student body.
And I should say, Checker, I mean, look, you know, a war on exclusivity doesn't sound so bad, right? And, you know, there's a lot of people who certainly are skeptical about meritocracy, you know, that you're talking about some of these kids are, you know, the kind of kids who were born on third base and thought they hit a triple, right? I mean, that, you know, coming from advantaged homes and well-educated families, on and on and on. So, you know, there is that argument, right, that we're rewarding kids who maybe are themselves didn't have to work so hard to get into these schools, but, you know, they just were born lucky that they were born super talented academically, and that was nurtured by their own parent.
Well, sure, there's some of that, and that's not a completely invalid criticism, though if you look at a kind of national human capital point of view, smart kids, wherever they come from, are needed to be cultivated into tomorrow's scientists and inventors and entrepreneurs. And a lot of these are kids from middle and lower middle class homes who may have education-minded parents but don't have the rich parents that would otherwise be, as it were, sending them to boarding school. And they are kids who need this kind of education, have proven that they thrive in this kind of education, and they can get into this kind of education. So it's not that the kids who get in oughtn't to be there. It's that the demographics of who gets in don't look like the community. And the big issue is that the people trying to solve this problem are not going to the root of the problem. They're trying to solve the admissions process and essentially redistribute a scarce asset by rationing it in a different way. Instead of going to either of two solutions, which they should be, One is, let's start in pre-kindergarten with these brown and black kids who are equally smart and just need to be cultivated through elementary and middle school, and they pass the tests too. So start young. Don't wait till high school to try to ration this problem. Get more kids prepared. Alternatively, increase the supply of these schools. Instead of having 164 of them in the country, have 16,000 of them in the country, have 1,600 of them in the country, so that there's more capacity and they can take more kids of different kinds of backgrounds. Those are the right solutions instead of this, let's do away with the thing that's working because we don't like who's benefiting from it.
Yeah, and obviously there are parallels here with the higher education debates, right?
Absolutely.
Right. Most selective colleges and universities haven't expanded their enrollment much, if at all, over the last, say, 30 years, even as the number of students has increased dramatically. And your first argument, start with pre-K. I mean, that was sort of the original idea of what used to be called affirmative action, right? Let's take affirmative action to prepare more young people for these opportunities. And look, we know, we've put out studies that have shown that if you are poor or if you're black or brown, you are less likely to have access to gifted programming, even if you're showing the same academic potential as your white or Asian peers, right? That there's just not as many gifted programs in say, Title I elementary schools. That's something we could and should fix. Though, look, you know, again, given the huge achievement gaps that show up as early as we can measure them, you know, that's not going to solve the problem entirely, right?
Well, but that's why I said pre-K. You can take pre-K back as far as you want to begin to compensate as best we can for able kids who don't have many resources at home. We'll probably never fully compensate because parents will continue to matter and the accidents of birth will continue to matter. We can't totally overcome those, but by getting smart black and brown kids ready for kindergarten and then into gifted programs and such, accelerating, moving at their own speed, however you want to put it, through good elementary and middle schools, we have a different demographic taking those tests in eighth grade.
And you're not against all of the reforms that have been out there, right? I mean, so for example, in New York City, they have expanded the number. They did, under Bloomberg, expand the number of...
I think they went from 4 or 5 to 9, if memory serves, of the schools.
Right.
They wanted to have at least one in each of the 5 boroughs, and they did.
Yeah. Or maybe that was it Bloomberg or even before that under Harold Levy?
It was both. It was a combination of Harold Levy and Joel Klein.
And you're not a big fan of how Stuyvesant does it, which is by looking only at test scores, a test that is actually in the statute in New York State, right? I mean, that you've certainly said that it, you know, you're okay with looking at more holistic admissions process like you would see in an Ivy League university.
Well, and like Thomas Jefferson in suburban D.C. has used for years, they use a test as a kind of threshold to get kids into a qualified pool, and then they use holistic admissions to decide which of those get in. It's sort of like the medical schools do. First, you have to get a minimum score on the MCAT, and then you get interviewed and get recommendations and things. I'm also in favor of universal screening for gifted education in third grade. I mean, so that every kid is looked at closely, and every kid in the district. Maybe even take the top 5-10% from each school in the district. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of ways to make this better. The issue with holistic admissions, which I am strongly in favor of, is that it's expensive and it's also corruptible. It's got to be awfully carefully insulated or the governor's cousin's kid gets in to a holistic system.
And more to the point, it hasn't actually worked to solve this disproportionality problem, right? I mean, that is what Thomas Jefferson has done. I think also Lowell out in San Francisco.
Yes.
And they still have these big problems where they just don't have very many black and brown students. So what both of those schools are now moving towards, it sounds like, is saying that they're going to take a broader group of applicants that have met some kind of initial screen, like you said, you know, test scores or GPAs, and then pick them by lottery. Just do it by lottery.
And right. I understand that they're going to probably end up doing that, though there's a big fight about it at Thomas Jefferson. A lot of pushback against the lottery approach. I think for a good reason. Kids who get lotteried in don't necessarily want to be there. And they're not necessarily hard workers. They're not necessarily motivated. They're not necessarily going to make the most of this extraordinary opportunity that a school like TJ offers its students. I think there needs to be an element of get up and go on the part of the kids. And I'm not sure getting into the pool on the basis of your middle school grades and then getting lotteried in is going to produce the greatest benefit from a school like that.
Mm-hmm. No, it's a little bit like saying, I don't know, if you can run a 40-yard dash in 6 seconds, then you get into the lottery and will then pick, decide who gets on the varsity football team, right? It's not necessarily the way to pick certainly the best players or get the best outcome. David, what do you think? You want to get in here?
I have, I think, very little to push back on against Checker on this. I guess there's a couple points I'd make. One is just to take a step back and ask why we do this in the first place, right? And I think, as I understand it, one reason is simply that if you look at a standard normal distribution, the tails of that distribution are a long way from the center. And so, you know, there is a large chunk of kids for whom your basic normal standard education is about right. And then sort of a smaller number of classrooms or schools that are sort of designed to get the most out of kids who won't be served in that. And so, you know, at a basic level, I think there are some intuitive, logical reasons why we do this. You know, regardless of exactly where you stand on politically or on any number of other issues, right? I think maybe where this is a lot of this is coming from is that it can feel like that it's tough to find a point of entry in the cycle of poverty. I think that's where a lot of this comes from, right? In other words, we've been fighting this for a long time, and we don't always seem to be making as much progress as we might. You know, it isn't always obvious that there's political will, you know, for solutions. So people are looking for something, some way that they actually think will make a difference. But I do agree, simply on the basis of closing achievement gaps, if that's what you care about, we're talking about a tiny number of kids. This will not close achievement gaps. You know, even if sort of the folks who want to change it get their way, it simply won't.
Right.
I don't think we're going to close the achievement gap this way, but we could come closer to closing what some people in the field call the excellence gap, which is to say getting a broader representation of our demographics into the high-achieving ranks. That, I think, is doable. It's doable in a bunch of different ways. I mean, a well-functioning honors program or AP program combined with a gifted program. You don't have to have these separate schools as the only way to do this. A highly personalized, move-at-your-own-speed approach to education would also help. In this regard. But I do think we have to worry about who is ending up in the sort of top 5%. But I don't think the way to solve that problem is just to say, let's redistribute the top 5%.
Yep. And as you say, you know, it starts in preschool, it starts in elementary schools. And so, you know, look, the Hechinger Report's been running this series on gifted education that seems to go from this premise that somehow that it is racist or it's elitist, and therefore we should just get rid of it. You know, right? It's that leveling down instinct. Instead of saying, no, what we need to do is expand it, is to make sure that every high poverty elementary school or any elementary school that's got a sizable number of kids of color have these programs to get kids on the trajectory. Yep. Because knowing politics, look, these programs aren't going to go away in the affluent schools, the schools that mostly serve white kids. They're going to be here forever, right? The question is whether we're going to also get kids of color and poor kids into the pipeline too.
That's right.
And districts, Mike, there is nothing stopping us from creating an exam school in a high poverty district, right? The cut score might not be the same, right? Yeah. But the principle of it's the same. Yeah. And the kids will
they have
be
them.
Different.
All right. Hey, we got to leave it there, Dan. Good stuff. Thank you, Checker. Hope you'll come on again sometime soon.
I'll fly in anytime you want me.
All right. Now it's time for everyone's favorite, Amber's Research Minute. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Mike.
Just having a good conversation there with Checker about exam schools, of course, focused on public schools. But do you know, guys, what I just found out that I hadn't realized? I don't know how this escaped me. Do you know that Joe Biden went to an elite Catholic school for high school?
That rings a dim bell.
I don't know how I missed that, but I found some article. I need to check this out. But according to this article, and it was from a reputable source, that he basically worked his way through that high school, that his family couldn't afford the tuition. And so he struck up a deal with the school to get at least some kind of big discount. And he did menial labor during the summer to kind of pay his way, which is pretty cool. Kind of makes me think of Christo Rey a little bit.
Yeah.
Amber's not taking the bait, Mike.
So, I'm just pointing it out. It's interesting. But he is also yet another candidate, another Democratic candidate who enjoyed getting to go to a private school and does not support taxpayer funding for private school choice for other kids. So
Or maybe he's a conservative, Mike, and he, you know, he thinks everyone should pull themselves up by their bootstraps. Yeah.
No, that's interesting. I remember Newt Gingrich back in the 90s said something about poor kids earning their way through school by basically taking over the role of janitors, and we could save money on janitors as well. I think that's sort of how it went. That proposal did not meet with a lot of...
It didn't go anywhere.
No, as I recall.
Didn't think so.
But there's something to this idea, All right. But what do you got for us this week, Amber?
All right. We have a new study that examines the labor market outcomes for community college graduates, specifically what the returns look like for both associate degrees and certificates over time. So I like this because we hear a lot about four-year degrees. We know they have higher returns on average. But we know much less about how associate's degrees and certificates compare to one another. And they're often appealing in theory, right? Because we think they can be completed more quickly. And maybe they're in these applied and technical fields where kids might get decent earnings. So just a little context before I get into the study. Community colleges confer over 1.5 million what we call sub-baccalaureate credentials each year. So that includes associate's degrees, which are typically supposed to be completed in 2 years. Long certificates for programs for at least 1 year and short certificates for programs less than 1 year. So that's kind of what we're talking about here. Researchers examine earnings and other outcomes relative to terminal associates and certificates only awarded in the state of Ohio over 11 years. So we've got about 96,000 students who enter college for the first time at age 20 or older. You know, they wait till 20 so that they can measure pre-college earnings. And they're looking at kids between the years of fall 2001 and spring 2004. This is important. They exclude students who subsequently enroll in a four-year institution so that their effects are not capturing any value of transferring or completing a further degree. They use an individual fixed effects model that it compares students' earnings before and after enrollment. So they're looking at the pre-post education earnings change associated with the highest degree earned in a two-year college. They use non-completers as a control group to account for any earnings growth that may have been expected regardless of the credential attained. And they also control for student demographics, entry cohort, and degree intentions, since completers and non-completers could be on different earnings growth patterns for reasons unrelated to credential attainment. It's a pretty robust study. The findings. Number one, the value of an associate's degree grows substantially after graduation, while the returns to a long-term certificate are flat over time in general, and the returns to short certificates are flat for women, but grow over time somewhat for men. Returns to associate degrees are notably higher in the recession years versus the pre-recession years. They look at the Great Recession. Associate's degrees lead to improved outcomes relative to non-completers across a range of outcomes, including higher paying jobs, more stability in employment over time, and a greater likelihood of earning a living wage, which is defined as $30,000 annually. For example, the effect of an associate's degree on a living wage is 25 percentage points for women compared to a 13% percentage point effect for a long certificate. Certificates, however, do pay off via the employment margin, which basically means whether or not someone has a job at all. And certificates help with reduced likelihood of claiming unemployment insurance. Another little random finding here, 2/3 of enrollment in these programs are in two fields, health and engineering. And we see that for both men and women, the highest quality earnings gain upon graduation comes in the health-related sector, and particularly for associate degrees. However, only 13% of associate degrees are in the health fields for men compared to 40% for women. So men are kind of missing out on an opportunity here by not pursuing the health sector. They close by saying caution is warranted in terms of promoting certificates on par with associate degrees. Since although long certificates have a payoff, that payoff remains flat or declines over time over this 11-year period they looked at, with the exception, again, of engineering certificates, which men can do pretty well if they have a long certificate in engineering. And then what I thought was interesting is, you know, we talk a lot about, okay, these types of degrees and completion, they could be advantageous because of the completion time, right? They can get it quicker than the four-year degrees, but that seemed lost because they gave you some descriptive statistics. The average time to completion in their sample was 4 years for the associate degree, 3.6 years for the long certificate, which is supposed to only take a year, and 3 years for a short certificate, which is supposed to be like a 6-month program. So you got to keep that in mind.
These are then working adults then, it sounds like. It's taking them a long time, probably because they're working at the same time.
Presumably.
Yeah. Yeah, no, look, this is really interesting. Of course, it brings to mind Fordham's own study on the college earnings premium across states and metro areas, which was able to dig into some of this, although, you know, we had the frustration with census data that we couldn't distinguish between people that had certificates versus just dropped out of college after starting, right? There was this category between high school and 2-year degrees that was kind of all those people mixed in together, the some college category. But now it makes sense. I will say, you know, one question, kind of methodological, but has implications, is we shouldn't think that the people who, it isn't the case that people who are likely to complete these programs are different in important ways from the people who don't complete the programs. And therefore, isn't it those differences that could be driving the outcomes in terms of earnings or employment? In other words, you know, the same people that maybe start but don't finish a certificate program, you would expect that they're also people who maybe can't keep a job.
And Mike, they do some other sophisticated analyses that try to control for motivation.
Okay.
Which I think is what you're getting at, that I did not get into. But yeah, that is something they tried to consider.
Yeah. Or what the technical term is, do they have their shit together? right. I mean, again, not to say, of course, there's plenty of reasons why somebody might struggle to finish these programs. But, you know, yeah, I mean, right. Certainly as an employer, if I see that somebody started but didn't finish a program, that's a warning signal to me. So.
Right.
Yeah. David, what do you think?
Yeah, I don't have a lot to add, except that I think, you know, we're never ultimately going to get beyond the selection question completely. One thing that is pretty clear is that, you know, you can't necessarily generalize from a population that completes some of these things to other people. In other words, you know, it's not necessarily like if you complete a particular certificate and you see a good result, you know, that we should be shoving lots more kids into that certificate program. It has to be right for the kid and it has to be a good program, et cetera, and so forth. So, you know, I mean, I guess I just think this is probably where the conversation ends. I mean, to be honest, right, is these programs show good results. We should support them. I think in some ways, the sort of policy implications of these sorts of conversations to me seem to be more on the flip side. In other words, if there are programs that don't seem to be working, given that like the young adults are presumably interested in those programs or more interested in them than the general population, you know, it's a warning sign and, you know, you can't sort of get any sort of benefit from them. And maybe that's baked into the cake with some careers. I get that. But nevertheless, right, and particularly with this sort of comparison, if you're looking at completers, non-completers, right, I think it's almost more about sort of separating the wheat from the chaff, right, and saying, well, we can't exactly quantify these programs' benefits, but these other programs you should think twice about. So that's my take. Yep. I'm out of the wheelhouse as usual here.
Well, and this thing about the flat returns, again, that makes sense, but it also means that for young people, it doesn't mean you shouldn't do those certificates. It just means that you might have to keep doing them if you want to keep getting a higher salary over time. So you do a certificate, you enjoy the benefits from it, and maybe that 5 years from now, you're going to need another one. Tom Friedman this week writing about how this is the future of education as people are going to have to keep, you know, learning new jobs, new professions, and get upskilled in order to do so. That certainly, for those short-term training programs, that probably is the case.
Well, also to plug yet another upcoming study, it would help if we knew the value added to particular industry recognized credentials, right? So we know that, you know, if you're going to pursue this particular IRC, you have a better return on it.
Yeah. Well, that's why, you know, healthcare, that was great to see those findings around healthcare. And it makes sense. I mean, that seems to be a sector where they've really done a lot of good work about having a very clear career ladder, a lot of investment into helping people who come in entry level or a little bit above entry level continue to grow in their careers and opportunities. So yay for healthcare.
for men. Okay.
Yeah. Oh yeah. And men, get over yourselves and be a nurse. Come on.
That is actually a pretty clear takeaway, I think.
Yeah. All
it's
right.
Not new, though.
Good. Hey, like it. Very helpful, Amber. Appreciate it. And, but that is all the time we've got. So until next week.
I'm David Griffith.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at FordhamInstitute.org.